Welcome to Oncology Today, Optimizing the Management of Synovial Giant Cell Tumors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Emanuela Palmerini from the IRCCS Instituto Ortopedico Rizzolio in Bologna, Italy. And to begin, she discussed the taxonomy and pathogenesis of TGCT. So maybe you can just talk a little bit about kind of the evolution of understanding of this entity. I know that initially it was called pigmented villonodular synovitis. I don't know when it changed into TGCT. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the evolution of how this entity was, you know, first described, and now a little bit about your vision for the pathogenesis?
Yeah, so I think the taxonomy of this disease is the most peculiar thing. In 2012, the WHO named this entity tumor for the first time. But the discovery of a pathogenic translocation, so the pathway towards tumor, was much older, 1994. So, but in the past, it was a disease treated mainly by orthopedic surgeon, and it was called pigmented villonodular synovitis. Since this name change, everything changed, because all the pathway was, even through a discovery of a new class of drug specifically targeting TGCT pathway, and we will see it is a CSF1 receptor. Actually, is the most popular target ever, because it's very, very close to the target of imatinib, the first precision medicine drug ever approved in chronic myeloid leukemia in 2000, and then in active in GIST subsequently. So this change of name really correspond to a discovery of an entity that has a neoplastic growth, but also as a target that calls in a lot of inflammatory cells. So the mass, the lump, it's a combined tumor and cells from the tumor microenvironment that are activated by the disease itself. That's the reason that the disease also responds to steroids, respond to ICE, because ICE closes and reduces the blood supports to those inflammatory cells. So the inflammatory component of the disease might respond also to those kind of treatments.
What is known about, like, the normal biology of CSF1?
So this receptor usually is not present in the normal cells, but it's specific of a certain type of tumors, like, as I said, chronic myeloid leukemia or TGCT, but also gastrointestinal stroma tumor. The difference is the pocket. So there are these receptor among diseases are similar, but they have specific pockets. So the different CSF1R inhibitors developed, like imatinib and nilotinib, are not specific for the pocket of the receptor of the TGCT, while all the new classes of so pexidartinib and, for example, but also vinseltinib, they target the pocket much precisely. And then there is the emactuzumab, but is a monoclonal antibody, so a different class of drugs, but targeting the same receptor.
Could you talk a little bit about the clinical presentation and how that evolved into the two major subtypes?
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to see a lot of this patient, because I don't work in a cancer center. I work in an orthopedic hospital. So patient coming into my clinic, Istituto Rizzoli, they have an orthopedic disease. That's the reason that most of the patients with this disease are referred to Rizzoli. And we collected all the retrospective cases from here, but also we combined with those of Memorial Sloan Kettering and Milan before these drugs came up, to have a picture of the clinical presentation and also of the relapse rate of this disease. So usually patient come in with a big masses on their knee. They usually report not being able to walk properly, to work properly, or to exercise properly. So since this entity usually affects young adults in their 30s, it's a very, very dramatic deterioration of their quality of life. Of course, it depends on the tumor size and the tumor type. In fact, this disease exists in two types. The nodular, it's usually about 1 or 2 centimeters and affects mainly the fingers and the small synovia. Also might be found in the knee as in the picture, but usually fingers of the hands, for example. And this is quite more frequent, 10 person per million a year, while the diffuse is usually it's all around the bone, and it might destroy it also the bone. In 10% about of the cases, it's also affect the bone, and it's likely much rare, 4 cases per million per year.
And in terms of the diagnostic workup, what's seen? Is there a difference in the histopathology of the localized or nodular and diffuse type? Can you make a diagnosis based on pathology?
Yeah, thank for asking this. No, the pathologist needs to see the imaging, which is the case for all the bone and the soft tissue the differential diagnosis. And they look very similar under the microscope. What differentiated is the appearance on the MRI, which is the main diagnostic procedure. And I want to clarify that MRI without contrast media is already a good diagnostic tool, unlike other soft tissue sarcoma that requires contrast media, because TGCT it's characterized by dark appearance, so dark in T1 and dark in T2. This is very easy to remember and very easy also to look. You can see within the red narrow, the color is very similar to that of the muscles.
Yes, I'm curious what kind of clinical practice you have. Do you see patients with other cancers or disease entities or just patients with this?
Being 20 years working at Istituto Rizzoli, I am a sarcoma medical oncology, so I mainly treat young adults and pediatric patients with bone tumor like osteosarcoma and Ewing sarcoma, and all kind of soft tissue sarcoma of the limbs that you might not know are 175 entities. Most of them benign, and I don't see them because their treatment is surgical only. But several also malignant, and those benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy, and so I see all that patient. This entity is an exception because biologically is benign, but I use to call this tumor locally benign but locally malignant, because relapse often, and it is very aggressive. So the impact of the disease, as discussed, may be as bad as a malignant disease, although metastases are rarely observed. There are anecdotal lung nodules and anecdotal also lymph nodes involvement. But we had also dramatic cases with lymph node involvement, and also the biology of the cells into the lymph node was consistently benign. So no lot of atypia, hypocellularity. So it is should be underscored that this tumor does not kill, does not give in the future metastasis.
So, you know, it's interesting. We've had the opportunity to do a number of programs on very uncommon entities. And one, it's just in a strange way, kind of reminds me, and I was wondering if you take care of patients with desmoid tumors.
Oh, yeah, you are right, because they share the benign feature. So the primary cell are a very low cellularity, low atypia. But they also share the clinical attitude to relapse, actually desmoid even more. The desmoid was in the past treated by surgery, but then we understood that cutting a desmoid tumor was like cutting the root of a tree. So the much you cut them, the much they regrow and they come back much worse. So we switch from a surgical approach, especially for desmoid of the limbs, to a medical approach ranging from chemotherapy now to recently approved gamma secretase inhibitors. So yes, it is similar. Benign, but very locally, very aggressive.
The other thing I know you see in desmoid, but I haven't seen this in terms of this entity, is spontaneous regression. You know, the desmoid tumors you see, you know, tumors shrinking in the control arms of these studies. I assume you don't see that here?
Yeah, I agree. That's very fascinating of desmoid. No, that does not appear. There are a couple of cases in the waterfall plot curves that we will see, but are not like really regression, like 20% as in desmoid, which is really impressive. No, in this case, most of the patient are stabilized, that which were the most common feature. In fact, another important point of this disease is the frequency of the scan. If you scan them frequently, they will be stable for a lot of time. But at some point, they start to regrow, and often their symptom is important, even if they are like very small, because they are very close to nerves and tendons, especially the localized. I saw yesterday two patients and had both that this was very, very bizarre. Both had suspect TGCT on their fingers, and they complained also after surgery, I cannot use the computer, my arm all sore when I use it. And so they grow very close to important structure. So that's the reason also of their symptomatic presentation.
The other thing I noticed too, again, you see in desmoid, is it's seen more in younger people and in women. Were these two patients young women you saw?
Yeah, in TGC, the desmoid are...
No, TCG.
In TGCT also, yeah, the presentation age is around their 30s, and they're more female, so very similar.
Any explanation for why it presents so young? It kind of suggests maybe a genetic, a hereditary issue. Is there any evidence of that?
The pathogenesis is a translocation, but why it occurs at that specific age and more in the specific gender is not known.
In terms of the more common being in women, any hormonal effects, hormonal therapy work, anything like that?
No, yeah, that's very well understood in Des Moines, but there are no such evidence in TGCT.
Another thing I was curious about, you mentioned that corticosteroids are helpful. There seems like there's some kind of inflammatory component here. And do you actually see arthritis as a consequence of it?
Yeah, so there are both the what the disease causes to the bone, so the continual inflammatory stimuli produces a secondary osteoarthritis. This is very important to address before starting any treatment because that arthritis won't respond to any medical treatment. And then there is the component of the disease itself, which is the tumoral cell in crosstalk with a tumor microenvironment, which it's very, very characteristic because in the MRI of this patient, we see a lot of fluids, for example, that they come up to us with a story, oh, I went to this orthopedic surgeon, he did the arthrosynthesis for once and then a second time, and then it was like, oh, maybe we should see another specialized orthopedic oncologist, and then the orthopedic oncologist operate on them, and then they relapse, and then they come to us. So, yeah, one of the most characteristic feature of this disease is the very long patient journey, which is driven by the symptom of this inflammatory component.
Do you think it's possible that this is actually a much more common entity that's just not being diagnosed?
No, I'm not convinced because there are, as I said, also the small ones are very symptomatic because all affect our joints and they usually get worse and then they go to see someone, maybe a rheumatologist, the arthritis physician, but it is unlikely that they get undiagnosed.
Is the diagnosis usually made on imaging with MR and the clinical presentation, particularly for these patients with localized disease, or is a pre-op biopsy usually done?
No, you're right. Unlike other tumor, not only in this disease, the biopsy is not always required, but I think, it's very up to the orthopedic surgeon. That it's always important because there are always exceptions to the rule. So usually it's dark and dark on a T1 and T2 with those features. But there are other diseases. So I remember a case I saw last summer. It was a former basketball player from Sardinia. She came to me with a lump under her knee. It was very regular, nodular, like less than 2 centimeters in larger size. So it looked like a localized TGCT of the knee, like a book imaging on an MRI. In our clinic, we have medical oncologists and orthopedic oncologists in the same floor. So I called for my orthopedic surgeon and he was completely agree on the potential diagnosis. And he was like, okay, let's put this patient on list to just excise this benign operable tumor. And then after a couple of weeks, I met this orthopedic surgeon, Professor Donati, and he told me, you know, I decided to biopsy on her. And I saw her after a week, and then the diagnosis came out. And it was not a TGCT, it was a synovial sarcoma. So just to underscore that every case might be very different. So it is really important to have a truthful study with the MRI and also always a multidisciplinary discussion. One very important thing is the observation. So the biology of this disease is indolent, so they won't grow fast. although they might be very, very large and very painful, while other sarcoma, of course, in 1 month, they would change very, very quick. So it's important to always to watch for follow-up slide of our patient before biopsy. I see most patients after biopsy, so it's something up to the orthopedic surgeon, but they should be wise to ask for, especially at the beginning, to ask for follow-up of their nodules, also those that looks very benign.
So for the patient with localized, well-circumscribed disease, do these patients all go to surgery, or do you see whether or not they have pain or not, or they, if it looks like it can be taken out, you take it out?
So, yeah, the standard treatment, of course, if they are symptomatic, it's surgery. But I think that we are at the beginning of a paradigm shift on our treatment, because surgery might be bad. One of my cases of yesterday, the finger, she was like, the nodule is already back after 6 months. Also, my finger is numb, and on the scar, it's really dramatically painful. And because, you know, if you operate on fingers, it's not like operating on a tight or on a larger soft tissue area. So it's very, very important to assess with the patient all these important issues. Is also the age and the profession of the patient is important, because for a pianist it would be much important to be carefully considering his capability to play in again. Why for an old patient maybe a surgical removal might be much easier. So yeah, I think that all these systemic treatments coming along will change in the future our armamentarium, and also in those nodular cases, the discussion will be much open.
So I want to spend some time with you hearing about some of the systemic agents that are out there, but just a couple more questions about the broad group of patients. For patients who you're going to observe, how do you follow them? Do you follow them with MRIs? And how do you determine how often to do MRIs?
Usually, yeah, MRI with no contrast medium. And there are general rule, usually at the 6 months at the beginning. And then especially if you treat upfront with a surgery, you will... Ideally, it would be nice to have an MRI after surgery to see for residual, because there is another great concept about the disease. There's no ERS0 surgery in TGCD, meaning that it's very, very difficult for the surgeon to clear all the joint without putting at risk functionality. So the morbidity of the surgery is accepted in a malignant tumor, but this is a benign. So the therapeutic window is much, much smaller. So yeah, usually they operated first, and then the first MRI, it's shortly after the first surgery. And then I think in the first couple of years, 6 months, that if do not relapse, I think once a year is more than enough, especially because if the disease relapses, the patient will know. So all our report will end in anticipate in case the symptoms and sign of the disease come back.
What about malignant TGCT? I'm curious, over the years, how many patients you've seen with that? Where, you know, what's their usual course, site of metastasis?
Yeah, in one word, bad. It's a very sad disease. I see a few patients because likely it's ultra rare. Pathologically, they are all different cells. They have a bizarre nuclei, a much higher cellularity. And the patient usually start with a soft tissue tumor, but then all the there is a very high frequency of nodal metastasis, and the metastatic spread is pretty quick, both in lymph node and the lungs. And the treatment usually mimic those of common malignant soft tissue tumor, but this disease is chemotherapy resistant. Probably due to its pathogenesis, sometimes it responds to anti-angiogenetic and multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitor like pazopanib, but does not respond at all at CSF1R inhibitors. It's like there's another pathway activated per se.
So I'm assuming radiation therapy has limited or no role in the disease?
I really thank you for your question. Radiotherapy is widely used in bone and soft tissue sarcoma, especially Ewing and malignant soft tissue sarcoma. Usually do not recommend any radiotherapy in benign lesion. And the reason is that radiation therapy has evolved very nicely, and now we have precise conformational and also tomography and also stereotactic radiation therapy. So there are several techniques, but all radio therapeutic treatments, especially in pediatric patient or young adults, harbor a risk of radio-induced sarcoma in the future. So it shouldn't be performed in a benign disease.
How much of a need is there in your view for education about this for medical oncologists and orthopedic surgeons? You know, it is a rare disease, but we're doing a webinar later today on lung cancer, and there, you know, some of the targeted therapies, NTRK, et cetera, are extremely uncommon, yet we still talk about it. Do you think that oncologists and surgeons need to know more about this?
Definitely orthopedic surgeons and rheumatologists and general practitioner should be educated about this rare disease, because the long journey of this patient might be very painful. In my experience, which now is 10 years long with this disease, I had the opportunity to be close to the global community of TGCT patients. And so I heard several of their history. And it's quite painful when you have a disease and you do not really know where to go or to be referred. Now it's almost impossible, you know, because we have social media. It's funny enough, I have patients that would be seen by my surgeon, and then they got online, and they would come to see me, not because our internal link, but right after, because they were in the TGCT patient community educated to do that. So patients have new tools to reach out for referral centers, but still I think that general practitioner orthopedics should be educated on this entity, and of course of the opportunity that the new target might harbor for their patients.
Are there advocacy groups or patient groups? I know with desmoid, I know there was a big advocacy group that really was instrumental in getting that nirogacestat study done. Has the same kind of advocacy been out there in terms of this entity?
Yes, it's very similar, actually. The group is called TGCT Support. The leader, it's Sydney Stern. She's been doing an incredible work to reach out in all all the parts of the world were to spread the knowledge of this disease. Their website is very instructive with all the center and expert to be referred to. But also they collaborated, for example, on a position paper on best clinical practice on TGCT. Wow. So they with all the European experts. So this is something that without their support wouldn't be same. So I think that in the last years, the synergy in between patient and researcher and the treating physician has been, in this rare disease, has been really successful.
So let's spend the rest of our time talking about systemic interventions here. And first, maybe you can talk a little bit about if there is a typical scenario or what I would imagine most patients are in pain when they get started on treatment.
So it's usually, and it was inclusion criteria for the study, yeah, you should be symptomatic. So at least four of pain. And most of the patients were relapsing after surgery. Now that there are differentiating between people living in different areas, because as you might know, in Europe, there are no systemic treatment approved for TGCT, while in United States, the 2 of August 2019, pexidartinib was approved. Although it is approved under this REMS program, so the FDA accepted that the drug was an opportunity for the patients. In the registrative study, there were a couple of cases of severe and also very long, 7 months long hyperbilirubinemia. The FDA decided that the prescribers should be trained, so not everybody can follow patient with on pexidartinib with the objective to spare risk for the patient, so to be continuously monitored and to prevent any bad side effects from the drug. So the discussion might vary among continents based on availability, but there are also compassionate program, off-label use. So in this disease, it's usually a multidisciplinary discussion. We take into account the symptom, the morbidity of the surgery, the sequelae from prior surgery, patient preferences, like if you are on treatment, you cannot have children, so that definitely impact on the choice in between a surgery or a medical treatment.
I want to hear more about the specific alternatives, and I know that one of the first, if not the first one that was used, was imatinib. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about imatinib? Are there any situations now where it's actually utilized?
So imatinib, as I said, is the most popular because it's the first example of precision medicine. The data on imatinib in TGCT are exciting because are the first, but we have only a small retrospective series reporting on 22 patients. So in those 22 patients, the response rate was below 20%, so good but not good enough. And I think, although some patients respond very well, as I said, the new avenue has been open from the most specific CSF1 receptor inhibitors. So as you can see from this diagram, the pexidartinib target a specific pocket within the CS1 receptor, and that make the activity much, much higher.
So, yeah, and I want to hear more about pexidartinib. I guess one thing that's interesting, though, is that I guess the way these tumors grow is not necessarily concentric. They're more finger-like. And you like, what do you calculate total volume? Is that the way, that's
yeah,
the way you do it?
I like that you use the finger like, because it's something very related to our common practice. Oncologists has to measure response. And the most used, actually, the standard and the FDA approved method, it's called RACIST. RACIST uses the major diameter of the biggest metastasis. So, and it's monodimensional, and it's just a line. So to see the response, you have to add on the length of this metastasis and compare in between before and after. In TGCT, this just doesn't work properly, because the disease is more like, it's like the bread around an hot dog. It's all around and circular. And then when the drug start to kill the cells, the bread is as the same length, but it's much, much, much more tight and close. So the diameter that reduces more, and which is responsible of all the symptoms, is not the longest diameter. So that's the point. So this tumor volume score was developed, and this is an actual measure of all the shape of the disease. So it's much more close to the real burn of the tumor, and of course, nicely depict the response to drug in terms of reduction of tumor volume.
So can you talk a little bit about the pixidartinib trial? I don't know if it was considered randomized phase 2 or randomized phase 3.
So pixidartinib or Enliven trial was published back in 2019 in Lancet. Was of enormous contribution to the discovery of this disease. And it's very important because it combined for the first time dimensional measures like MRI to other important endpoints under the umbrella of patient-reported outcomes. So since this tumor do not kill, survival, overall survival, is not important in this disease. So other endpoint should be considered. So patient-reported outcome in terms of pain, but also in terms of, for example, to walk on a stair or to climb a stair or to do grocery if you have a disease in the upper limb, all of that, and other objective measure like range of motion. This is a very different approach to patients. So to study drugs for TGCT, you really need a very well-trained team made by orthopedic surgeon, and also physiatrics, all those people that is trained to measure these changes over time. It's not very difficult though, but it should be standardized. And also this patient collected usually in this study through iPads or the iPhone, lots of changes in their daily activities, which is really, really important to describe the overall effect of their drug and on their quality of life.
I'm curious, did you put any patients on the study?
Oh, I was super good in doing that because of the opportunity to work here at Rizzoli. I clearly remember all the patients I spoke with. Actually, I screened 16 patients, which is an important number if you consider that the whole world, it is 100 patients. But we ended up to include 11 patients because the study closed prematurely due to the one single case of hyperbilirubinemia more than 7 months. So yeah, all the patients had a great experience with the drug. Actually, it was a placebo-controlled study with crossover. So all patients entering in the study eventually will receive pexidartinib, but some at the beginning and some after 6 months. And the assessment of the disease was done at weeks 25. The most important change in those patients was the color of their hair. Since they were often young patients, it was quite impressive see them all white, which is one of the specific side effects of this disease, but it's totally transient. And the activity was impressive during the treatment for most of them.
I always like to ask people who put patients on placebo trials if they could, you know, figure out whether or not the patient was on a placebo. So I'm going to guess that, well, first of all, I don't know what when the hair turns gray, but I guess as soon as it turns gray, you would know. But I'm guessing that maybe you would notice because their pain got better.
Yeah, you see all of that. You see the lumps getting smaller. And then you see on the labs, actually, the drug of this class causes also enzyme, a specific enzyme is called CPK, creatine phosphokinase increase. It might be like, I don't know, 10 to 20 times the normal. So you clearly see it was on drug. But yes, all these side effects are transient and they are really related to the drug. So the trial and, of course, the clinical use allow us to adjust the doses. So sometimes like half of the dose would do the work for some of the patient. And as compared to imatinib, the objective response rate was much higher. Was about 60%, 59%, so very, very good.
So, of course, the waterfall plot, it looks like almost everyone that goes down. What's the actual schedule, and how long do you use the treatment?
Yeah, the patient take the pill every day, actually twice a day. But as soon as you stop the drug, there is a drug holiday possible, but in a few months, most of the patient experience relapse. So this is a continuous treatment. So you have to balance in between disease and signs and also the side effects. So some patient found an ideal dose from that trial. And also from a compassionate program, a couple of patients that are on trial for several years now, but the dose is like one quarter of the initial dose. So like minimal doses can be well tolerated for long, while full dose might be not well tolerated. So it depends on tolerability and also symptoms burn on this specific patient.
I'm curious what you thought when you first saw these waterfall plots.
I was really impressed. In oncology, it's very, very unusual, especially in sarcoma field. So I think these waterfall plots underscore that you hit the target, that you got a driver, as we say, that it's really impressive, especially with at least 13%, which is 9% with complete response. And actually, we saw them. Actually, one of those 9 patients is one of our cases. Actually, it was a compassionate program, but I remember a patient treated with pexidartinib with a gigantic diffuse TGCT of the knee. It is a 35-year-old bartender, and he couldn't work. And we discussed this case with our orthopedic surgeon, and they were like not really feeling to operate on him because it was super diffuse, and the likelihood to clean all the knee was very, very very low. So since these treatments were coming up, they were like, oh, please treat this patient. Of course, I don't think that with this large mass you can achieve any good, but we don't either. So let's start first. And then the patient after a few weeks got better, and then At the second assessment, he reached a partial response, and then after 6 months, a complete response. We went back to the first surgeon. He was really surprised. Actually, in their minds, it was a neoadjuvant approach. They would like to operate on him after treatment, but then eventually had nothing to operate on. The patient wanted to have a family, so we stopped the treatment. And then after 6 months, the disease came back. And after 1 year more, we put him back on a different trial. So what I'm saying that our learning curve is improving, and surgery and CS1R receptor inhibitors combination might be different in the future.
What about quality of life issues with pexidartinib? Anything? We'll talk about hepatotoxicity in a second, but what about other side effects, GI side effects, et cetera?
Yeah, they complain, actually. It's a very peculiar. Some patients from the south of Italy, it was like, oh, you know, doctor, I cannot grill any longer because the hair are white and all great, and the skin become very, very sensitive. So you can grill because it would be too difficult to tolerate. Another bad side effects is periorbital edema, which is might be painful, but it's dose dependent. So you can decrease the dose, and of course, yeah, the worst is increase of transaminase, ALT-AST, and bilirubinia, cholestatic changes. So it's very important to check on those and to all the treatment as soon as possible in case of those changes.
So anything else you want to say about what's known about hepatotoxicity? You mentioned there's a REMS program. What's involved with REMS other than, you know, sort of checking liver function?
First, it's the first time in my life that a drug requires an exam. You actually have to give it another test. I mean, you are like a certified medical oncology, and there is someone asking you to be certified specifically or something. So it's something like, I think, very, very unique. But other than that, I think that was very smart from FDA to find a safe way to not dismiss an important path toward treatments for pexidartinib. So I think it was very good. I don't think that it can be predicted. Of course, we now watch for like steatosis, hepatitis, of course, all those comorbidities should be watched after. We don't abuse, of course, paracetamol. But, you know, when bilirubin started to increase and you cannot stop that, it's something that it's out of our control. So you should be just really careful to monitor bilirubin and stop treatment as soon as you see unexpected toxicity.
I guess one issue is, as far as I've seen, it appears to be reversible.
The bilirubinia?
Yeah.
Yeah. Most of them, yes. The problem is in a selected patient, and those that were into the trial, a couple of patients, it was reversible but lasted long. So the problem is that for a benign disease, you don't want that. There is also a case with leukemia that had a liver transplant, and you definitely don't want that in a benign disease. But again, the doses were totally different. Pexidartinib in TGCT, it's 800 milligram now, so it's much lower. In leukemia, the first study had more than 3,000, very different.
So what about vimseltinib? Can you talk a little bit about what we know about it and how it differs?
So yeah, vimseltinib is the second drug that reached the regulatory, not approval, but it was recently submitted to FDA. This drug, it's very highly effective, very similarly to pexidartinib. It was studied in a phase two study in two different schedule, but for brevity, I will just tell you that now the dose is 30 milligram per day, twice a week. So the treatment is not to be taken every day. So maybe for the patient that it's easier. There is no color change or hyperbilirubinemia increase, but of course there are transaminase increase and also periorbital edema and skin changes, diarrhea, all those oral side effects may be reported. The results of this motion trial, this trial just came out and there were published in Lancet in June 2024. Vimseltinib was able to outperform placebo in all the endpoints, of course, racist, but also all patient-reported outcome, range of motion, and all these promise, which are physical function target that were developed specifically for TGCT.
So I know it's always difficult to compare indirectly between the trials, but I'm curious how you, from your point of view, vimseltinib compares to pexidartinib in efficacy and tolerability. And would you like to have vimseltinib available?
Yeah, I think that for Europe, that comparison is not even necessary because we don't have and we will never have pexidartinib. So we are eager to know if there is a way to approve vimseltinib in Europe. And for activity, if I were in United States, I think they are very similar. Like, as you can see, the waterfall plot, it's impressive. And so it's definitely a good drug. For tolerability, periorbital edema is a concern, fatigue. There is also the increase of an enzyme, CPK. It's often observed, and that also causes drug holidays. But, you know, in this disease, drug holidays is not necessarily a great deal because the disease is already responding and does not progress during those holidays. Some patients refer very bad arthralgia or muscle pain, so those might be also a concern.
Do you think the effects on the liver are necessarily different than pexidartinib, or with all the history that we already have with pexidartinib, or you think that if you had access to both of these drugs, how would you decide?
Yeah, I think there are no direct comparisons, so it's very difficult. But both should be better used in patients without liver problems. So I think that wouldn't be enough to decide.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the monoclonal antibody to CSF1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, emactuzumab is the most recent drug that was developed for TGCT. The first published study included 63 patients, and 92% of the patients had TGCT in the lower limb. Again, this monoclonal antibody had an impressive waterfall plot in terms of tumor shrinkage. There is an important difference in design of the clinical trial for this disease. First, the placebo-controlled trial is enrolling now, so we don't have the data. We will have probably in 1 year or so. But the design is very different because patients do not receive the drug till progression or drug interruption per patient decision or investigator decision. They do receive the drug only for 5 doses. So this might be very useful to our decisional algorithm because, for example, young patients that have to plan their active traveling life, family planning, might would be more willing to go into a hospital to get intravenous drug for a short time, but with a promise of a cure, which we don't know, of course, because the study are still ongoing. But yeah, the idea is to treat for a short time, and that might be impactful in this kind of young population.
Anything you want to say about the toxicity of mactuzumab?
Very similar, I think, to vincelsinib, although, as I said, the data are very, very preliminary because the controlled study is still ongoing. I think it should be waited for the result of the upcoming study.
So let's talk a little bit about these cases. You have a 34-year-old mother of two who has had 5 recurrences.
Yeah. So just so to show you that TGCT, when patient develop a relapse, it's for the surgeon, it's really impossible to clean the knee. So the disease keep relapsing, and the patient that usually should be active and be mother, they have a really bad impact on their quality of life for this disease. This patient of mine was in screening for pexidartinib, but could enter for the drug toxicity and the study premature closures.
So was she actually treated?
No, she couldn't because the study was closed prematurely. She was waiting for the drug and then she underwent another operation, 6 surgery.
Oh, I see.
So this the example of nodular TGCT to underscore that you can use systemic treatment or also in case of very small diseases, especially when TGCT affects fingers or structure very close to nerves. So you can discuss with your patient, especially if they're using their hands. And nowadays, everybody use their hands with the computer. I think might be a good opportunity at least to try and see before risking the morbidity of the surgery. But of course, I'm not a finger or hand surgeon, so these discussions should be shared.
It's interesting, though, that even though he didn't have tumor shrinkage, he had a relief of the pain after getting imatinib. And I guess you could say he's been on a drug holiday for 6 years.
But the point is stable disease is according to RECIST. Tumor shrinkage is on the other diameter. So as long as you clear the tumor from the edema and all the inflammatory changes, the pressure on the nerves goes away, and that's enough.
That's great. How about the 76-year-old farmer, a woman?
She's still on treatment. She's one really nice woman that came to us with this very large posterior mass. So she's a farmer, so she was very upset that she was almost unable to walk. And so we put her on pexidartinib, and her pain totally disappeared. And the range of motion, it's back to normal now. And she was also tolerating the drug very well after dose reduction. So in older patients, especially if you use pexidartinib off trial, you can also start with 50% of the dose and see what happens. She was tolerating it very well. And yeah, we keep her, her on treatment because of the very good tolerability and excellent quality of life. She still work in her farm in Tuscany.
That's great.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I was wondering if it was in Tuscany. I guess, was her hair gray before she got treated?
No, yeah. She was gray before, yeah.
And any liver function abnormalities that she had?
No, not at all at the beginning, but we decrease the dose at 200. So she's been on a very, you can say, homeopathic doses, one quarter of the usual dose. So you can really modulate the dosing of this patient in real world.
So 51-year-old female doctor and mom, always a challenge when you have a physician as a patient. This lady had 8 relapses. What happened?
Patient that actually came to us at the end almost of her history, and I think it's exemplify as the disease is really impactful in a patient life. So she met a very good surgeon at the beginning. The treatment were successful, but then the relapse was yearly, so every year she had a relapse. And then the most impactful and impressive thing to me, which I'm not an orthopedic surgeon, is that she came to me with all the disease around her knee prosthesis. So to underscore that no matter how aggressive you are with surgery, if the joint is compromised, the disease eventually will come back.
And was she treated?
Yes, she started pexidartinib as well.
How did she do?
Yes, she's doing great. She had a very important relief on pain, and she's followed by the orthopedic surgeon from the prosthesis.
Again, any tolerability issues? Did her hair turn gray? Any liver problems?
No, also she already tied her hair, so no problem at all. In the young male, the hair is the problem. And yeah, this is the case I already presented before. As you can see, the disease is not only in the arterial compartment, but also in all the posterior fossa. And it is impossible to, also with two surgery, because as you might have heard, TGCT patient undergo sequential treatment, surgery anterior and then posterior and then anterior. But in this case, the planned surgery was really, really aggressive. So I'm very pleased with the response of this patient, which is still with us with the second round and already responding. So all good.
Well, anyhow, I would imagine every time he comes to clinic must be a good day for you.
No, not always, because I treat a large range of different malignant and benign tumor. But you're right, when I see in my outpatient one or two patients with TGCT, I'm like, okay, today is my good day, because I'm almost confident that I can give them good advice, good explanation, and most of the time successful treatment. Not frequent for a sarcoma oncologist. You're definitely right.
I'm sure seeing him must be a pleasure. This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Palmarini, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.